From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. When dozens of powerful and well-known Hollywood celebrities took to the red carpet of this year's Golden Globes, their black dresses signaled a new slogan adopted in the wake of hashtag MeToo. Time's up. Speaking powerfully to the issue of sexual violence against women, these A-listers brought with them grassroots activists who have tirelessly worked on the issue. In her now viral acceptance speech of the Cecil B. DeMille Lifetime Achievement Award, Oprah Winfrey echoed the frustration felt by women everywhere over pervasive misogyny and violence aimed at women. But addressing sexual violence requires a multi-pronged approach. And while the Time's Up campaign has set up a legal defense fund to help women prosecute predators, what about preventing violence in the first place? My guest is Lisa Fougier-Parks. She is the Associate Program Director at the Prevention Institute, focusing on preventing violence. Welcome to the program, Lisa.
Thank you so much for having me.
So let's first begin by talking about the importance of women like Oprah Winfrey and all of the actors, Hollywood movie stars speaking out. Of course, this issue has become more prominent because of the revelations against Harvey Weinstein and the brave women who went on the record about the assault and rape that they faced at his hands. So I suppose it's only natural that they've continued to take a leadership role.
Yes, I really applaud what happened at the Golden Globes. I think, you know, we really have to give respect to the organizers and activists who have been for many years speaking up about violence and harassment, particularly low-wage workers working in industries such as restaurants, domestic workers, and so on. We're really in a better place, and the actors are in a better place because they have been speaking up for many years. So I applaud the organizers of these movements for the foundation that they really created. And I applaud the stars for using their visibility and their platform of the Golden Globes to really act in solidarity with women and people who have less power across a number of different industries.
What did you make of Oprah Winfrey's speech? I won't ask you to comment on her presidential aspirations. We're going to cover that on our program tomorrow. But the fact that one of the things that jumped out at me was the fact that she mentioned the term domestic workers and, mm-hmm. of course, told us the story, the very, very important story of Recy Taylor.
I thought Oprah's speech was amazing. And of course, it's, you know, not a surprise that it's going viral. I think a lot of people are really connecting with it and being moved by it. I thought her speech was important for a number of reasons. And again, I want to go back to the organizers of this that had such a strong presence at this event. I think their coordination and messaging was very clear and coordinated, and you see that reflected in Oprah's speech. Oprah talked about harassment and violence being rooted in power inequities, and she talked about gender, racial, and economic inequities, and she also named some clear calls for action. And when she said, you know, this is a signal for a new dawn, it was a very powerful declaration. And again, it wasn't just Oprah. It was Oprah and the activists and the actresses and many others all speaking in solidarity with each other that I think is so powerful.
Right, exactly. Well, you know, Hollywood women could very well have restricted their protest of sexual harassment to what they personally face on a day-to-day basis, which of course is an important issue. But what we see happening goes beyond the sort of corporatized approach to sexism, breaking the glass ceiling, etc., which is connecting the issues of sexism, gender violence to economic issues, to race issues, etc. And the Time's Up campaign, as I mentioned, has set up this legal defense fund, and the Center The National Women's Law Center has partnered with Time's Up to address this issue. So, of course, having the legal the financial resources to legally prosecute predators is critical, but it's only one piece of the puzzle, right?
Absolutely. And I saw a statement come out by the National Women's Law Center today that talks about both the legal actions that can be taken, but also more of the preventative actions that can be taken as well, how workplaces can shore up their policies and practices to try to prevent harassment from happening in the first place, to create safer, more equitable, and transparent workplaces. I would like to see the conversation go even further to talk about how we can understand that discrimination and harassment and violence really needs to be addressed in all of our community settings, throughout all of, you know, where we live, work, and play. So that means including schools, including community settings, including places where we worship and practice our faiths. These are all places where culture and norms are shaped. So in addition to addressing these issues in the workplace, let's extend the conversation out to in our entire society and the various places that our culture is shaped. And let's also talk about preventing these issues from happening in the first place.
Right. Your op-ed in the Sacramento Bee in December, rather November, I believe it was, addressed these issues quite strongly. So organizations like yours who have done this work for many years are now sort of getting even more attention because of the work just done since the summer, because of the attention from the hashtag MeToo campaign. Let's talk about how we begin addressing these, because first we have to identify the problem. Yes, of course, everyone can agree the Harvey Weinstein approach to interacting with women is exactly what we need to deal with. But how did Harvey Weinstein get to be who he is? How do sexual predators manage to get away for so long with their horrific deeds? In your on your website of the Prevention Institute, you address norms that society takes for granted, harmful norms that lay the groundwork for sexual predators. What are some of these norms that we need to identify?
Yeah. So, you know, like I said, I think one of the things that was really powerful about the Golden Globes was the statement that these forms of discrimination and harassment and violence are rooted in power inequities. And those power inequities are reinforced in part by policies, and we can talk about which policies and how to change those. And power inequities are also shaped by norms. And norms are the unspoken rules, but they are the way that things really work in society. And they give clues as to what's acceptable, what's not acceptable, and what's expected of people, whether to speak up when they see harmful behavior or whether to remain silent, whether it's expected of leaders to exploit people with less power, or if it's expected of them to share power more equitably. We do identify a number of social norms, cultural norms that really set the groundwork for sexual harassment and violence. And the great thing is that norms are changeable. We can all play a role. Once we understand the power of norms, we can decide which norms we think are serving us, which ones are not. And we can all take part in changing our culture and changing our norms, again, in the various places where we conduct our lives.
So what are some of the norms of masculinity and femininity that we unfortunately find children from the very young ages absorbing into their psyche through popular culture, through how parents and teachers might inadvertently send messages to children? Because, of course, it all starts in childhood, right?
Absolutely. I think culture norms are absolutely learned from day one of our lives and reinforced throughout our lifespan. And you know, many of us try to model and teach the values of respect and equity and transparency. And yet, again, there are some norms that contradict these values. So, for example, you know, it's complex, and I'm simplifying a lot of things right now, but there are norms of masculinity that really define masculinity in very rigid and I'm sorry, rigid and narrow ways, where there's an expectation that to be masculine means to dominate, and for example, to not respect boundaries. So, for example, if you are interacting with a person who is feminine, no doesn't mean no. It means keep trying until you get what you want. And that's the expectation, and that's what will be rewarded. So, on the one hand, we say it's important to respect boundaries. On the other hand, we have these norms that define masculinity in ways that contradict that. Similarly, we have, again, values of respect and equity, but then there are messages that define femininity as being about compliance and sacrifice. And so instead of speaking up or expecting equal treatment, there is an expectation that we will remain silent or that we will go along to get along, and that being accepted, especially in environments that are traditionally male-dominated, is more important than protecting our own safety and
Right,
well-being.
so this idea of sexual harassment and assault being a private matter, not something that we should expose. You know, we might expose all sorts of other things about things that we find out happening in the workplace. But when it comes to the issue of sexual harassment, as we found, for example, in Congress, the way to do it is to quietly settle, make victims sign non-disclosure agreements, and then sweep it under the rug and say, we've addressed the issue because we've given the woman in question some money to shut her up. And that doesn't help other women, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's one of the most harmful norms, and it really shows how we are all playing a role and we are all complicit in the continuation of these kinds of harassment and violence. And I actually don't use the word predator. I think when behaviors are normalized and expected, and when we all take part in creating the conditions, of course, not in the same ways or to the same degree. But when standing by when someone is being harassed or taken advantage of is normalized, then you know, is it really about one bad person or one person's bad behavior? It's really a larger cultural problem. If we think of the problem as a problem of a few bad individuals, in some ways we're reinforcing the very systems that create the problem. Those people who are fired, their lives go on. They will, you know, show up in another space. It doesn't necessarily help to change behavior. So I'm really interested in how do we have conversations that help to make safety and accountability a shared responsibility.
Right, so we identify the harmful norms and then work towards prevention. Let's talk about the prevention part of it and the fact that there are already a number of campaigns in place that perhaps just need greater attention or more resources to make them more widespread. On your website, the Prevention Institute's website, you have a spectrum of prevention. What is a spectrum of prevention? I'm assuming this is sort of a part of a standard presentation that is often made to workplaces.
The spectrum of prevention is a tool that was created by our founder many years ago and has been used in many communities throughout the country and internationally on a wide variety of health and safety issues. It is a tool to think about once we've identified what contributes to a problem, how do we go about changing the problem? And it really shows that we need many strategies, not just one strategy, but we need many strategies. We need that solidarity. We need those partnerships, and we need to work for long-term change. And so the spectrum of prevention does include policy change. There are many policies that are being enacted and that we can get behind that will create better working conditions, more economic and gender equality.
So things like equal pay for women as an example of what you mean by policy change, legislative change.
Absolutely, equal pay, eliminating the tiered tipped wage system, better working conditions and economic security.
Raising the federal minimum wage could be seen as a way to prevent violence against women because women tend to dominate the low wage workspace.
Absolutely. So these policy changes that get at creating greater economic, racial, and gender equity are absolutely important. And the spectrum also recognizes that policy change is not sufficient to change our norms and culture. We need a number of different strategies that really transform all of the different settings in our communities where these behaviors are learned and reinforced.
And that's part of that cultural shift you were talking about.
Absolutely. So in our organizations, whether they be schools or workplaces or faith communities.
Or progressive media outlets like Alternet, where we found, you know, even among, we may imagine that progressive spaces, nonprofit institutions where there is a stated adherence to feminism and the ideology of gender equality, there are still plenty of men who abuse their power because we just take it for granted that they're going to put their ideology into practice, but it doesn't happen.
Yes, and you know, again, I think inequities across race, gender, class, and other factors are systemic and generational and multifaceted, and so it's not a surprise that abuse of power occurs in different settings. You know, I think once we can really open our eyes to seeing that no industry is immune, no workplace is immune, then we can say, okay, let's keep our eyes open. Let's invite a conversation about these issues. Let's continue to work on it and improve over time. Mm-hmm. I'm very excited because there are actually a number of very effective programs and examples and models of what workplaces, schools, and other settings can do to really shift the norms and culture and create safer environments.
So finally, let's also talk about what tools there are for schools to use, because again, we come back to this issue of addressing how harmful norms get adopted from childhood. If we address these issues, if we raise children that are aware of sexism, violence against women, and given the tools to prevent that in their own environment and in themselves, we address this in a long-term fashion. And I know your organization identifies a number of existing campaigns. So what can those of our, among our audience who might be parents or teachers, what are some tools that they can use in their own schools, in their own homes, or recommend that their schools adopt?
Yeah, thank you for bringing that up. I think the school environment is a really promising setting. Again, it's not sufficient. We really need to address these issues in every setting in our communities. The school is one place where we can have a significant impact. One of my favorite programs is called Shifting Boundaries, and it's a program that was implemented in New York City middle schools. The name alone really helps us to understand what we really need to do, and it really names respect for boundaries as a critical skill that people need to learn. And this particular program is focused on middle schoolers, but it really focuses on shifting the entire school environment. So it is also multifaceted. It changes the discipline code to address boundary violations, not simply from a you broke the rules, you need to be punished sort of an approach, but really recognizing that people need to understand what a boundary is, and they need to build the skills to be able to respect someone's boundaries. And that takes modeling, that takes practice, that takes reinforcement. So This program includes education on respecting boundaries, setting up agreements between students and others, respecting boundaries agreements. It also includes mapping the school environment where students are asked to identify the places in their schools that are safe and not safe. And then the school commits to changing the physical environment of the school to make it safer. And oftentimes what this means is just changing the way that people are interacting, providing better supervision and support and positive engagement in those settings so that, again, that positive modeling and that positive reinforcement is happening.
Also and I should also mention, this isn't only about, for example, protecting girls from sexual violence. We know that little boys are just as vulnerable victims in many instances when they are children. So this is an issue of safety, security, preventing future, you know, a lifetime of trauma and scarring and basic justice overall that we need to address these issues. And who knew hashtag Me Too could bring up such a large intersection of issues, but certainly unless we address them all together, we won't really solve the problem. Lisa, give out a website for the Prevention Institute.
Yes, it's www.preventioninstitute.org.
And we'll post a link to that from our website later today. I know a lot of the campaigns we were discussing are linked from your website so people can find out more information there. Thank you for all the work you do.
Thank you.
My guest has been Lisa Fujie-Parks. She is the Associate Program Director of the Prevention Institute, focusing on preventing violence. We've been discussing what it will take to prevent sexual violence and harassment. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, and Vimeo.